Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From crop circles to alien abductions, the human sense of extraterrestrial life has long been the obsession of an imaginative fringe. But a rapidly growing group of space scientists is overtaking science fiction with science fact in the search for life beyond Earth. It now appears the universe may hold thousands, even millions, of Earth-like planets. The surface of Jupiter's moon Europa is bathed by an ocean of water, the critical building block for life. Magnetic evidence of some ET might have slammed into Earth on the back of a Martian meteorite, and NASA is taking note. America's space scientists are plunging into astrobiology and the search for definitive proof that humankind is not alone. Have you kept up? Are you ready for this? Do you believe that we are likely to find extraterrestrial life? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from NASA's Ames Research Center at Moffett Field, California, is Dr. Chris McKay. Good evening and welcome, Chris McKay.
Good evening. My pleasure to be here.
Good to have you. Chris is a member of the NASA Astrobiology Institute, and with us in the studio tonight is Kelly Beatty, executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. Good evening and welcome, Kelly Beatty.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you both. Chris McKay, jump in here with us. We understand that NASA is paying more attention to the search for extraterrestrial life perhaps than ever before. Why has this focus become such a big focus for NASA?
Well, it traces back a couple of years to the work done on the Martian meteorite, the very old meteorite that we have on Earth that came from Mars. Many years ago, about 5 years ago, a group at NASA Johnson published evidence of what they thought was life in that meteorite, microscopic life. Since then, one particular aspect of that evidence, the presence of little tiny magnetic particles, has gotten more and more attention. And in fact, we are having right here at NASA Ames a two-day meeting that's just wrapping up now, looking in detail at this microscopic magnetic evidence for life on Mars. And the answer is that it still could be that this is evidence for life. I don't think that we've reached a consensus, but the argument, one of the participants today said it's really a horse race. The arguments against life are good. The arguments for life are good. We really can't rule one out or the other.
But this meteorite that slammed into Earth from Mars and I guess was discovered in Antarctica has been kind of the starting gun for a new era of seriousness about looking for life. Tell us the story of the meteorite and why it's been so important in getting people's attention focused again on the possibility of extraterrestrial life.
Well, ever since the Viking missions to Mars some 20 years ago, there's been a building interest in the notion that Mars, early in its history, had water, had an Earth-like period in the sense that it had liquid water present on the surface. Maybe not Earth-like in being as warm as the Earth, but Earth-like in having water, liquid water, and that, of course, is the critical environmental requirement for life. Well, that interest was growing over the last 20 years, and in a sense, the meteorite was just the final straw that just really blossomed interest in this whole issue, because the scientific community was ready to believe that there was water on Mars. We understood now that life was really tied to liquid water. And so the finding of the meteorite came at just the right time to really galvanize this interest in Mars, early Mars, and life on Mars. And I think, as you say, it's really grown exponentially over the last 5 years.
Why were scientists so hepped up by the idea of life on Mars or the possibility? I'm reading here now that there's a sense that there could be many, many Earth-like planets in the universe. Is it Earthocentric to be so excited just because we found something on Mars? Even if there were nothing on Mars, what do statistics suggest about the possibility of life elsewhere?
Well, we've always guessed that the universe is full of planets, and those planets, some of them must have life. But we never knew that for a fact. What we knew for a fact is that the universe had a lot of stars. And some of those stars, many of those stars, were like our sun. But we never really had definite evidence that those stars had planets. And I think one of the breakthroughs of the last 10 years has been direct evidence now that indeed there are planets around some of those stars. We haven't yet detected Earth-sized or Earth-like planets, but just the fact that we can say, yes, there are stars, and yes, there are planets, really, I think, lends the first statistical support to the notion that there might be other Earths around other suns, and that those Earth-like planets could have life there. So outside the Earth, there's growing interest in detection of planets. On Mars, we have the evidence of the meteorite and the possible evidence of life in the magnetite. And on Earth, we're finding ecosystems in strange places that we never thought we'd find them before.
Deep sea and so on.
Deep sea, under ice, and so on. And so putting it all together, there's this growing enthusiasm for what we now call astrobiology.
Kelly Beatty at Sky and Telescope magazine, you obviously spend a lot of time thinking about looking at the skies. Do you feel this surge in interest in extraterrestrial life? Humans have always been fascinated by the idea, but do you feel the mounting interest in the scientific community?
I think NASA has a mandate now to go and search for life in ways that it didn't before. During much of the 80s, after the Viking missions, in an ironic twist, Mars was actually planet non grata.
Because
NASA's focus was elsewhere, and there were sort of under-the-table meetings called Case for Mars conferences where people who had the fire for Mars were meeting sort of on the side without any kind of NASA support. It's a hot planet now. Life in general is hot not only because of the meteorite that Chris spoke of, this Martian meteorite,
mm-hmm.
But also it came at a fortuitous time for the space agency. It was mired in building the space station, and people would ask NASA, what next? What is your goal? Where are you going? And, you know, sending people around the Earth incessantly is not a very good long-range goal. So they
it's boring after a while.
That's right. They latched onto this idea of origins, our origins, the origin of the solar system, the origin of the universe, as an umbrella mandate where they could park a lot of projects. And this life is a thrilling one, no doubt. It also happens to be a politically exciting one, both from the standpoint of politics and also from the standpoint of everyday people. They can get behind this because they want to know where we came from.
Do you buy that analysis, Chris McKay, that NASA is latching on here to something that's politically convenient and maybe perpetually interesting, so you'll always have a rich agenda?
Definitely, definitely. And in fact, NASA's had within its charter the search for life beyond the Earth since it was originally formed. But as Kelly points out, there's a growing political interest in this, a growing public support for it, and NASA certainly views that as to its benefit.
Chris McKay, give us a little beginner's cook's tour of the efforts that are underway to perceive, to sense, to establish life, the fact of life outside, off the Earth. What's going on? What are the efforts?
Well, I would say there's a couple of different directions that are being pursued. One is to go and try to search for it directly. Dig it up. Dig up the dead bodies on Mars first, and then maybe even Europa second. And
this is the moon of Jupiter.
Yeah, those places are close enough that we can imagine actually going to them with shovels, so to speak. The second approach is look beyond the Earth into the distant stars, look for Earth-like planets, and then search for signatures of life on those planets, like, for example, oxygen. If we see a planet around another star, it's about the size of the Earth, it's about the distance from the sun, its star that the Earth is from our sun, mm-hmm. and it's rich in oxygen, well, we've got a very good case for life. So there's a remote detection, look with telescopes, and then there's a let's go to Mars and dig approach.
Have there been technological advances in either or both of those that make their work more effective now?
In both cases, the technology has improved. In the going to Mars and looking, we're improving the computers that work on spacecraft. We're improving the miniaturization of the instruments and the mechanisms, building rovers. We're doing things that much better and more efficiently. The telescopes are where the advances are really mind-boggling. What Hubble can see, what the next generation telescope can see, and what these humongous telescopes that are being built on the ground can see. I saw a design the other day for a telescope that would be 100 meters to be built in a desert site. So the telescopes are just expanding enormously to sizes that are just hard to believe. And with new technologies like adaptive optics, things like that, we can essentially see through the atmosphere and see images that are no longer blurred by the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And the promise of these new large telescopes is really quite thrilling.
How much more access to the universe are these larger telescopes giving us? Is it doubling our access, our ability to look on out, tripling more?
Well, in many ways, I'd say it's an order of magnitude increase in that we can see with the telescopes like Hubble in orbit deeper in time to the earlier parts of the universe. And with these adaptive optics and large telescopes on the ground, we can see more clearly the near term, the near field objects or nearby objects, possibilities of resolving planets with respect to a star. So you have a little tiny planet next to a really big bright star. It's a challenge to be able to see that planet within the glare of the star. People are coming up with clever ideas. Things like square mirrors, believe it or not, are one way to help resolve...
Square mirrors,
because then...
Instead of the circular mirror on the telescope, you mean?
Yeah. Instead of having a round telescope, build a square telescope, and then the glare of the star tends to go up and out like a... like an X pattern, and if you rotate that X pattern so that the planet is in the middle of the legs instead of on one, then you can see the planet much better. So there's a lot of clever tricks that people are using to investigate things 10 times better than we could before, 10 times further and 10 times clearer on near-term things.
And Kelly Beatty, the search for Earth-like planets is obviously an exciting one. What the presumption is that if a planet has Earth-like qualities, that the odds of it having life as we understand it are much higher than if it doesn't.
Well, as Chris pointed out, you need to have water, liquid water. Oxygen is not a requirement for life. There are some types of bacteria on the Earth that actually die in the presence of oxygen, anaerobic bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
The search for these other life forms, in a sense, carries with it our preconceptions of what life is. And therein is the complication. We carry this sort of Earth-centric, anthropomorphic notion of life, carbon-based life that, chlorophyll-converting carbon dioxide into oxygen. The notion about finding oxygen is predicated on the fact that oxygen, in a normal sense, would not be what you'd expect to be around another planet. It combines too readily with other minerals and other atoms. And so if you find a planet with oxygen, it's likely that could be one where life has been generating it all along. You know, astronomers are very clever. They can take a single point of light, which is what these planets will look like once we're able to detect them directly, and extract all kinds of information around it. For example, as the Earth turns, the amount of light it reflects because of clouds and continents and such changes.
Yes.
So
mm-hmm.
that's one indication.
Kind of a kaleidoscope.
Kind of a kaleidoscope. Well, we wouldn't actually see those continents from afar, but we would see them as
the differences. Irregularities.
Mm-hmm. Another way is spectrally. When we look at the spectrum of the Earth, we break down its light. We see things that could give us clues, like oxygen and like other molecules that suggest life might be present there. This is all sort of inference, and astronomers are as good at this as any other.
Chris McKay, we've got a lot to talk about this hour, and we're coming up on a break. But bottom line, given all the advances and everything we know now that we didn't know 10 or 20 years ago, for you personally or for the scientific community, has it raised the sense of possibility? Do you feel that it's more likely, given what we know now, that there's life, or are we still at kind of a neutral, we really don't know until we know?
Well, I personally feel that within my career, within my lifetime, we will have either discovered another Earth-like planet, Earth-size, Earth-distance, Earth-like, around another star, or we'll have found a clear, definitive evidence of life on Mars, or both. I think I can look forward to those two events, and I'd be very excited by either of them.
That's a high and keen expectation. We're not talking about decades and decades or centuries here.
No, we're talking about the next 10 or 15 years, maybe 20 years.
Whew, so coming right up, maybe. We're talking this hour about life out there, about the possibility of extraterrestrial life, and about all the new effort that is being poured into determining whether or not it's out there. What do you think? Are we alone? Do you want to find out? Do you feel new technology bringing us closer to knowing if there is life beyond Earth. We're joined tonight by Chris McKay. He's a planetary systems researcher at NASA's Astrobiology Institute, and Kelly Beatty, executive editor at Sky and Telescope Magazine. You can join us, too, at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University, this is
a new form of primitive life. And look, it's leaving its nest.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about life out there, about the new urgency and excitement in the search for extraterrestrial life. And the question, I guess, is, are we alone? Do you want to find out? And how important to you is the search for life out there, life beyond Earth? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Andrew. Andrew, welcome. You're on the line.
Oh, hi, man. I just wanted to ask if what would be the closest planet that would have extraterrestrial life out of the solar system?
I mean, outside our solar system, Andrew, you're asking what might be the closest planet where there's a possibility?
Yep.
Well, let's put it to the scientist. Chris McKay, do we even have a sense of where that closest planet, outside the ones we know here, that might have the possibility of life?
No. Right now, we've only been able to detect planets that are much too big to be like the Earth. So we need to improve our technology so that we can see smaller planets, and then we'll be able to find one that could have life.
Why is size a problem, Chris McKay? Why couldn't a very large planet have life?
Well, the planets that we can detect right now are very large. They're as big or bigger than Jupiter, and they're very close to their star, so they're very hot. And we think that for a planet to have life, it needs to have a surface, and it needs to have liquid water flowing on that surface.
Mm-hmm.
Or it needs to have a subsurface, like an ocean, with liquid water in there. The problem with giant gas planets like Jupiter is that they're just giant gas balls, and they don't have locations where water can pool to form a lake or a river or an ocean.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, the chemistry of those kind of planets is very dominated by hydrogen. And so it isn't easy for organic molecules, life like we know it, to build up into the complex forms that are possible on a planet that's small like the Earth, which has lost all of its hydrogen. Now, this could just reflect our own biases. I mean, this is what we have on Earth, so we think it's the best possibility.
Right.
Who knows? But based on what we do know, we're looking for Earth-like planets. So far, we've only detected these giant Jupiter-sized planets, but I think in the next 10 or 15 years, we will detect an Earth-sized planet. And then that will be the answer to your to the question.
And Kelly Beatty, to pursue Andrew's question a little further, what kind of range are we talking about in terms of distance that of other stars, solar systems, where we're looking at the possibility of Earth-sized, Earth-like planets?
The search that's been undertaken to this point and continues involves stars that are much like the Sun. That is, we call them solar-type stars. Stars come in a whole range of sizes and temperatures, so we want to start with those that are sort of in the same ballpark. And within, say, 100 light years of the Earth, there's 1,000 or so of those kinds of stars. That's where the search has been focused.
Okay.
That makes it the easiest, because if you were to find planets, then your telescopes have, you know, half a chance someday of picking these out of the glare of that planet.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, you can maybe amplify this a little bit. I mean, just because a planet is large and Jupiter-sized doesn't mean it's a Jupiter, a giant ball of gaseous cotton candy. It's again, this is our preconception that for a planet to be large, in the nebula that it formed, it had to have accumulated a lot of gas. And although that's a good model, there's nothing to say that a planet the size of the Earth will be the right size, and a planet the size of Jupiter won't.
Chris McKay, you agree?
It's a good point in that we have to be careful because we don't actually see these planets. We just see their influence, their gravitational influence. So, you know, Kelly's right in that, and I was sort of getting to that point when I said, based on what we know on Earth, we sort of tend to take our prejudices about life, about Earth, about the other planets in our solar system, and apply them elsewhere as well. Now, they might be right. It could be that those giant planets are gas giants, or they might be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, it might be right that life elsewhere is organic and uses water like Earth life does. Or it might be wrong. We always have to be careful of trying to make the whole universe just like us.
Well, let's note here first for Andrew, it looks like, Andrew, that we're looking at about 1,000 planets within 100 light years, if that's a, or stars, sorry, if that gets to your question. And thank you for calling. Chris McKay, you've said a couple of times that we can't bring earthbound preconceptions into this search. And I've seen your colleagues saying that we have to search in non-Earth-centric ways, that we're hostage to our concept of what life is along earthly lines. But how does one begin to bring non-earthly working assumptions into the calculus of searching for life?
Well, I think that, you know, this is a difficult question, and I'm involved in helping NASA develop its strategy for search. And I think I personally think the best way to proceed is to go ahead and search for Earth-like life, because that's what we know, what we're looking for.
We're most likely to recognize it.
Yeah. But to keep in mind the possibility that things could be different, and let serendipity do its work if it must, mm-hmm. if it can. But I don't think that we're capable of developing a strategy to search for something that we don't know what it looks like. So in a sense, it really is like the proverbial drunk looking for his keys
right.
under the light, because
right.
that's where the light is,
right.
whether he lost them there or not.
The cosmic conundrum.
Yeah, so I actually advocate let's go search for Earth-like planets and let's search for Earth-like life first. Let's try to recognize something that we are familiar with, but let's keep our minds open to the possibility that nature might surprise us.
It's a challenge. Chris McKay, Kelly Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Seth Shostak. He's senior astronomer working on Project Phoenix at the SETI Institute. Good evening and welcome, Seth Shostak.
Nice to be with you.
Thanks for being with us. Remind us of your project. You're searching not just for life there, but for intelligent life in the universe. How did this project get started? And give us a sense of its dimensions today, Seth.
Indeed, we're one notch up on the food chain when it comes to life. We're looking for the intelligent variety, the kind that might hold up its side of the conversation.
All those NASA guys are trilobites anyway. You know, they're all microbes.
Well, yes, but
just kidding, Chris.
There are probably a lot more microbes than there are intelligent aliens, but. This idea, of course, is a very old one. I mean, the idea of looking mm-hmm. for intelligence in space probably goes back thousands of years. But the modern implementation of that idea, the modern attempt to actually find the aliens, only goes back about, no, it's 42 years now. In 1960, there was an attempt by actually the chairman of the board of the SETI Institute, Frank Drake, mm-hmm. to try and eavesdrop on signals coming from some nearby star systems, presumably put on the air by intelligent beings. And that's, in fact, very similar to what we do today, although it's far more sophisticated now in terms of the technology and the approach.
So we have a sense of your huge dishes, I guess, listening and listening and listening deep into space. Have you heard anything yet, or is it just a constant hum?
Well, it isn't a constant hum. That would be very tedious, actually.
It sure would.
We haven't heard anything. Obviously, that has to be the answer, for otherwise you wouldn't have to ask the question, because you would know that we had heard something.
Well, but even a blip, even something to interpret.
Well, this is one of those experiments. It's kind of a one-bit experiment. It's sort of like being pregnant. Until you are, you are not. So, you know, we're like Chris Columbus halfway across the Atlantic. All we're seeing is water. And one of these days, maybe we'll see something else. We don't know that we're halfway, but it's that type of an experiment.
But let me put the question to you the way maybe it's been put to the FBI recently. What you're looking for is intelligent life. There's presumably you are picking up signals of some kind from space, maybe just to do with, I don't know, the motion of asteroids. I don't know how sound works in space or what you're picking up. But is there a connect the dots challenge for you to go through all the data that comes in and look for something that signifies intelligence?
Well, I would be rather reluctant to say that we have a connect-the-dots challenge, but indeed, you're quite right. The you know, the cosmos, nature, does produce a lot of radio static, quasars, mm-hmm. pulsars, you know, hot gas, cold gas. It all makes radio noise. But we're looking for a signal that's at one spot on the radio dial, a so-called narrow-band signal, the kind of signal that if you were to listen to it would sound like a flute playing one constant tone, if you will. That's the kind of signal that a transmitter makes, but no natural objects make. So that's what we look for.
And you mentioned your founder there, but talk to us about the Drake equation. I guess this is the basis on which SETI believes that there's reason to think there should be extraterrestrial intelligence out there, not just life.
Yeah, well, the Drake equation is an attempt to try and estimate our chances of success. This was an equation that was thought up by, well, Frank Drake, actually, in 1961 as kind of an agenda for a meeting being held on this subject. And he said, look, what you really want to know is how many civilizations are out there in the galaxy, in our Milky Way galaxy of 400 billion stars, whatever it is, how many civilizations are out there right now with their transmitters switched on? And so he just put down all the factors that govern that. I mean, how many stars are there, and what fraction of those stars have Earth-like planets, the kind that Chris and Kelly have been talking about? What fraction of those planets have life? What fraction of those with life have cooked up intelligent life, and what fraction of those have their transmitters on? That's essentially the content of the Drake equation.
Mm-hmm. And Kelly, Beattie, if I may, how do people look at the SETI effort these days? Does it look quixotic, or does it look like a kind of something, of course, humans would be trying to discover, and so we are?
I think there's a lot less snickering and laughter behind the backs of those like Seth and Jill and Chris who are doing this work. Back in the 70s, William Proxmire, a very powerful and influential senator, had what he called his Golden Fleece Award.
Right.
Perhaps we need him again today. But in any case, he would bestow this upon the government project that he deemed the most wasteful.
The biggest boondoggle.
Biggest boondoggle. And the SETI effort, the embryonic SETI effort, got one of the Golden Fleece Awards and, in fact, caused NASA to cancel wholesale its support of that program at that time. Since then, it's gotten a lot more respect. It's working hand in hand with the astrobiology, the whole fabric of that. And I would say, Seth, you've got respectability that you never had before, right?
Well, I like to think so, Kelly. No, I think that Kelly's absolutely correct. This is a program that in the past indeed was easy to make fun of. I don't think that's the case anymore. And I think the reason for that is indeed largely due to the work of scientists both here at the SETI Institute and, of course, at NASA and at the universities in which they've been finding planets. Planets are a dime a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
We still haven't found the Earth-sized planets, but we have found that planets at least are not rare. And, of course, the growing indications that there might be life, or at least once was life, elsewhere in our solar system. Because if Chris finds evidence for dead microbes on Mars,
yes,
well, you might say, okay, they're not going to play a very good game of Scrabble. Mm. They're not the intelligent aliens we're looking for, but at least that tells you right away that biology is fairly rampant. And so if there's a lot of biology out there, some of it is likely to have become intelligent.
Seth Shostak, keep listening. And call us first when you hear from us, intelligent life out there.
Will do.
Thanks so much for joining us. Seth Shostak is senior astronomer working on Project Phoenix at the SETI Institute. There are a lot of people who want to join this conversation. Let's turn to them. Dan is on the line. Welcome, Dan. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. A couple of questions. One is, I think, with respect to the search for what we have here on Earth, bacteria, we should recognize that most bacterial species, even within our mouth, cannot be cultivatable. And this has been demonstrated by PCR, the polymerase chain reaction, in which we have used methods of amplifying the nucleic acid of these organisms and have found bacteria that have never been described, never been cultured.
Dan, it sounds like you're a microbiologist. Help us stay with you. You're saying bacteria cannot be cultivated, so what?
Well, so it's fine for us to be able to demonstrate their presence here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
What we would be less likely to have are bacteria-specific nucleic acid sequences on Mars, if indeed there's, of course, life that is bacterial per se, or based on nucleic acid.
Let me put that to
there
Chris
McKay. There are other possibilities, of course, that it's not nucleic acid. And one final thought, so we're talking about an unknown from that perspective, that we may only be able to...
You're saying that life may not necessarily leave much of a trace.
Pardon me?
You're saying life may not necessarily leave much of a trace.
Oh, no, no. If there were bacteria there as an Earth bacteria, there might be a trace, as in nucleic acids that we would recognize as bacterial life. However, if it is something else, maybe we'd know there are nucleic acids, but that does not demonstrate that there is life. We also think of life as cellular, It could be that there is, well, self-replicating RNA or something that might be described as life but is not life as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
And that would leave open all sorts of questions that would be unanswered, where people would say, well, they have ribonucleic acid. Is it life? And people would argue back and forth. Final question with respect to SETI, just something to make people sleep a little worse at night.
Okay.
One of the assumptions that you might wish...
Dan, you're breaking up on us, Dan. What's that?
Okay. That a civilization only has a defined lifespan before it destroys itself. And if indeed that's the case, then one might argue that in the time between when we can send out these messages or detect them and destroy ourselves may be measurable in hundreds or thousands of years. If that's the case, we are in our infancy with many civilizations there. If they are like we, then perhaps they would like to conquer us.
Dan, thanks for your call. You're breaking up a little bit, but you're provocative. Kelly Beatty, what about it? Do people feel some trepidation about this deep space search for life, that in fact we may open Pandora's box that's too much for us?
Let me just address a couple of things that he pointed out. One of the factors in the Drake equation is, in fact, not only do you have to have an intelligent life, but you have to have it last for a period of time in order to overlap with other intelligent species over the billions of years of the existence of our galaxy.
So civilizations or lives aren't just ships passing in the night, the cosmic night.
Now, for example, take the human species. We've been around for a couple of million years, but we've been technologically advanced for only about half a century, if you want to call it that. And the question becomes, how long will that last? And this brings up an important point. I've often said, imagine that the Earth were covered with water, exactly as we have it, but covered with water. Then the most intelligent life here would be dolphins and whales. Arguably very intelligent. They have species, conversations and so forth, but they're not technologically advanced. They would never build rocket ships. And so that may be the farthest that our life here on Earth would ever advance in that state.
So they wouldn't respond to a radio signal. They wouldn't send one out. It doesn't mean they're not out there.
That's right. And Chris, I'll let you jump in here. The whole notion of if they come, will they attack us? Maybe you could outline the different kinds of scenarios for that people think of when aliens would come knocking.
And I guess, Chris McKay, that doesn't necessarily mean intelligent aliens. Even microbes could be a threat in epidemiological terms, I guess.
Exactly. And in fact, NASA's got a policy that's pretty restrictive in terms of bringing back material from Mars. We will bring it back and treat it like it is full of dangerous bacteria and viruses and contain it in a facility like a containment facility for those kind of diseases until it's tested and shown not to be dangerous, because you never know if there is life on Mars, whether it could be dangerous in terms of direct biochemical attack of life forms or just dangerous by taking over the way kudzu or other plants may take over an ecosystem without actually harming anything directly, just physically take it over. So we, in the NASA program looking at Mars, we worry about alien invaders, if you will.
Chris McKay, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about life out there, extraterrestrial life. Are we alone? Do you want to find out? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about life out there, the possibility of extraterrestrial life, and the new excitement, the new urgency in the scientific community about tracking it down. Our guests tonight are Chris McKay, he's a planetary systems researcher at NASA's Astrobiology Institute, and Kelly Beatty, he's executive editor at Sky and Telescope magazine. What would it mean to find life orbiting Jupiter, orbiting another star? And how important to you is the search for life out there? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Carl's on the line. Welcome, Carl. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
So I had 2 points, really. One, there's no doubt, really, in my mind, that there's got to be life out there somewhere just due to the scale of the universe and what know of that.
All right.
So I'm pretty sure about that. One of my points, which has been talked about actually somewhat, is the fact that, you know, life may not be Earth-like. And
right.
I was remembering a book that I read by a very famous physicist that was based on, you know, real physics, that was called Dragon's Egg, which was about life developing on a neutron star.
Mm-hmm.
So science fiction, but based on physics. So I just thought I'd throw that out there. And the third point was that I think it was the late, great Douglas Adams that said that the surest sign that there is intelligent life out there is the fact that it hasn't tried to contact us yet.
Carl, thank you for your call. And here again, Chris McKay, is this notion that NASA itself has, as you've said, that we can't expect that it's just like us. And yet, you say, life that is related to life as we know it is the life we're most likely to perceive if we stumble across it.
Right. You know, Dragon's Egg, that was a book by Robert Forward,
mm-hmm.
Which he speculated on life based on the strong force. Life on Earth, if you think of it in a general sense, is based on electrochemistry or the electromagnetic force. And if you actually look at the equations of electrochemistry, they're very similar to the equations of strong nuclear physics. And so you can imagine a model of life based on the strong force. And that's what Robert Forward did in his book, and it's very interesting and highly speculative. And in that story, the people didn't really know what they were looking at or looking for, and that's, mm-hmm. I guess, my point. We'll go out in the universe and we'll look for life like us, and if we stumble across something different, we'll hope to see it, and that's essentially what happened in that book.
Mm-hmm.
The explorers stumbled across this different type of life, realized what it was, and there was actually then a fruitful exchange. So we got to keep our eyes open when we go out and look and expect strange new world.
I guess we will. But I was also struck, Kelly Beattie, in what Carl said, that there's no doubt in his mind that there is life and even the suggestion of intelligent life. We are so bathed in fictional, in media accounts, of science fiction accounts of extraterrestrial life. Does it leave Americans jaded about this? Even if we found it, would we be underwhelmed because it wasn't as good as Romulans and Cardassians?
I worry about this a lot. The culture that we have has led us to accept blindly that intelligent species just zip around the galaxy as if there were nothing to it. And of course, when they arrive here on Earth, they either take us hostage and conduct experiments on us or blow up cities with their unheard of weaponry.
Or bathe us in a kind of cosmic Martian love, the kind of, the friendly Martians.
Exactly. I think the challenge is going to be to not only recognize that life when we see it, but recognize that we may not see it. And that is, we need to hold this experiment to the highest standards of verification. As the late Carl Sagan said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And this certainly ranks that way. I think that it is very likely, as Chris would suggest, that we will find life very soon in some form on Mars or evidence of it somewhere, but it's unlikely to be anything other than microbial life. I think that forming microbial life is relatively easy. It's getting it up to the scale of humans and beyond that could be the tough part.
Chris McKay, if it is microbial life and if we find it, how do you describe to a lay audience the significance of that to people on Earth?
Well, I think that there's two ways to discuss the significance of finding even little microbes on Mars. One is, it tells us, as Kelly indicated earlier, that, and Seth also mentioned, that the universe is full of life. If right here in our own neighborhood we have two examples, then I think that's good evidence that the universe is a friendly biological zoo. The second thing, though, which is more practical, is that most of the science that influences our everyday quality of life, medicine, agriculture, diseases, and so on, is rooted in biochemistry. And mm-hmm. having another example of biochemistry could be very important in a very practical sense. So it's both a philosophical find, life in the universe, the universe is biologically friendly, mm-hmm. and it's a practical find in maybe giving us important knowledge about another way to write the book of life, another way to do the tricks that biology
does. Pursue biology and chemistry. Let's try and sneak one more call in. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hi there. Good evening.
Good evening.
I've got a couple of points that I'd like to bring up.
Be quick, John. Our time is running down.
The SETI at Home project is one that's near and dear to my heart.
These are when many individuals hook their computers up to help give computing power to the SETI project.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
There's about 3 million of us, and we've so far accumulated about 1 million years of computing time. So I'm pretty much a believer.
We salute your contribution. Take us to your bottom line here, John.
But the next big question, I think, is, if we find that there is intelligent life out there, what does that do to the religions of the world?
The religions of the world.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Good question. Let me take it and run with it because our time is so short. And, John, thank you for your call. Kelly Beattie, how does it figure in?
You know, religious people that you speak to think of God often as not so much a being, a presence that invades every nook and cranny of our lives, but maybe somebody that set up the ground rules and then let the things roll as they might have evolved in some ways. Certainly, there's a lot of overlap between, for example, the notion of creation and the Big Bang. That works for a lot of religions, and a lot of religions have this notion of a sort of Big Bang origin. I think that, you know, not every religion is rooted, as Judeo-Christians are, in the notion of God creating earth and
as his
man
soul project in life.
Soul project. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll come to appreciate that for just part of the master plan, if you will.
Well, there's a lot to think about. Chris McKay, you've really opened up my mind tonight with the notion that within your career, we're going to find this. Godspeed. I hope you do. Thanks for being with us tonight. Chris McKay is a planetary systems researcher at NASA's Astrobiology Institute. And Kelly Beattie, thanks so much for being here in the studio with us.
It's been great. Thanks, Tom.
Kelly Beattie is executive editor at Sky and Telescope magazine. You can continue this conversation at our website. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a Harvard professor surveys alien abductees. This is On Point. Like many of us, Harvard psychologist John Mack used to be skeptical of stories of UFO sightings and alien abductions. But then he started talking to people who claimed to have been abducted. And he started to believe that there might be something to their stories. Over the past 12 years, Mack has interviewed hundreds of supposed alien abductees. He is the director of the Program for Extraordinary Experience Research, which studies stories of alien encounters and provides emotional support to those who say they've been abducted. In this radio diary, Professor Mack explains how he came to believe that there is intelligent life out there and that it comes to visit the Earth frequently.
I'm a psychiatrist, and I lived with the notion that there was no other intelligence in the universe that wasn't a projection of the human brain, or if there was, it had to be proven, and we hadn't proven it. So when I first heard about somebody who in New York who had worked with people that experienced themselves as having encounters with strange beings from we know not where, and that there were thousands of these people apparently all over the country who didn't know each other, I thought this must be some kind of a new psychiatric syndrome. One of the things that convinced me as a clinician that this was not the product of somebody's imagination or something that came from fantasy or dreams was that these stories that I was hearing were consistent among many, many people from all of the United States and many other countries who had no contact with each other, who, when I started at least, knew nothing of any media descriptions that fit what they were undergoing whatsoever. And the only thing that I know as a clinician that acts like that, that is, people having an experience that many other people are having too, is that something really is happening. the basic story is that a person is in their home, or they're in a car, or in case of children in the schoolyard, and they hear a buzzing sound, or they see a strange light. They may see something like what we call a UFO up close, but they begin to have some kind of memories of something that happened, and it's not like a dream. They really, it's a memory of something that occurred in their conscious experience of seeing some sort of strange beings, of being taken somewheres, of having their bodies poked or probed, of some kind of reproductive element in this, of being given information about and images of what's happening to the earth, sometimes a feeling that they're being brought home in the sense of a deep spiritual kind of connection. There is physical evidence. In other words, people have been observed, the children have come into their parents' room when they're missing. I don't believe in every case the person is physically taken someplace. That is yet to be established, although it appears that happens on occasion. But there may be marks on their bodies, which little lesions or cuts or scoop marks, which correspond to what they remember happening to them during the experience. People may see a UFO near where the person having the experience has been undergoing the experience. Many people in the community may see some kind of bright lights that relate to the experience, not just the person who's having the encounter. The physical evidence is not strong enough for it to be proof. On the other hand, it's dangerous to dismiss this because we can't prove it by our methods of three-dimensional science. We need to be able to expand how we know to include valid human experience, but that has to be looked at rigorously as well. One of the things that convinced me, again, that I was dealing with some kind of genuine mystery here was that the people seem to have nothing in common one with another. There's no way to typecast the individuals. There was no personality consistency, no socioeconomic consistency, nothing about their point of view. They were almost without exception strangers to the phenomenon. And when it happened, they were as shocked as anybody else. And they would be sometimes come to me in the hope that I could somehow explain this away psychiatrically. They would prefer a psychiatric explanation than that this is somehow real and they have to contend with the shattering of their worldview as well as the distress of the experiences. I believe that if we can open ourselves to the possibility that we don't live alone on this in this cosmos, we're not the only intelligence. If we can open our hearts to an expanded notion of who we are, we might treat each other better. We might treat the earth better. We might be open to sacred realities, to the sacredness of all life. Because that seems to be what happens to these experiencers when they open up, when they go through the dark night of the soul of their encounters and begin to grasp the truth of it. So I think it has some creative possibilities for our consciousness.
John Mack is Harvard psychologist and director of the Program for Extraordinary Experience Research. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Where's the kaboom? There was supposed to be an earth-shattering kaboom.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.